From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want in this town.
Everybody thinks show business is really, really all right life. Peaches and cream.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, how and why the ambitious Norwegian adventure film Kon-Tiki was shot in two versions at once. Plus, a little-known U.S. filmmaker finally gets to make his movie, but in China, where he doesn't actually speak the language. First, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, we were among the many who jumped on Netflix a couple of years ago when they took some missteps and started trying to change how they charged people. But, boy, it seems like Comeback Trail has not only been hit, but they are well along on that trail.
Yeah, we beat the candy out of that pinata, and they are... They're back in good shape. They're filled with candy. I mean, they released some earnings that were amazing. And I think what they proved is that they are very much a peer, as they want to be, to HBO. Their subscribers right now, according to SNL Kagan, is about 27.9 million people who are streaming Netflix. And HBO is at 28.7 million paid U.S. subscribers. So they're very equivalent. They had great earnings. Their stock is taking off. And it really is setting up this dynamic of whether or not Netflix is, as Reed Hastings, its CEO, has maintained, the next delivery system for televised and film content.
Yeah, it's interesting because it wasn't like he was, you know, everybody watched when House of Cards went up all at the same time on Netflix. But we had no way of knowing from the outside, are a lot of new people subscribing because of House of Cards? And they weren't telling us. They aren't claiming some big effect. I think they talked about like a very gentle impact on their level of subscribers for House of Cards. But nonetheless, it seems to be a win for them in terms of branding. And they've got more to come. They have Hemlock Grove, which I think is doing better than House of Cards, although the critics don't seem to much care for it. And they have, Arrested Development coming up. So they feel, because of the data that they can get from based on looking at what their subscribers watch, Reed Hastings is arguing in this manifesto, among other things, that they can do a better job of coming up with content and not have, you know, the kind of catastrophic mistakes and failures that some of their competitors in the more conventional world do.
Yeah, the manifesto that you reference is a long letter that Hastings put on the Netflix investor portion of their website, where he makes a kind of a summary and a prediction of the television landscape. And his summary is that over the coming decades, and I'm quoting from it now, and across the world, internet TV will replace linear TV, apps will replace channels, remote controls will disappear, and screens will proliferate. As internet TV grows from millions to billions, Netflix, HBO, and ESPN are leading the way, unquote. The other thing he says that I think is really interesting, it's kind of buried in this manifesto, is that they're going to have fewer movies and TV shows, that they're going to become more aggressively curated, that Netflix used to be the place where you could find some very obscure movie, but it sounds in reading his letter that they're going to tailor their offerings a little bit more strictly and not be the end-all and be-all for all film and TV entertainment.
So it looks good for Netflix. The stock went way up after these results were announced. The only thing I'll say before we turn to another topic is that manifestos make me nervous. I feel like that is a thing that maybe you don't want to do a manifesto. But we know Reed Hastings has stumbled before, so we'll see whether we are once again going into a cyclical thing where he gets ahead of himself. Elsewhere on the internet, we have Zach Braff, the star of the long-running on a couple of different networks, Scrubs, and the director of a movie called Garden State. He has made a video for Kickstarter, a Kickstarter appeal, in which he's asking for a couple $1 million to make an independent film. And it's a very engaging pitch that he makes, in which he explains why it is that he is going to go to Kickstarter looking for a couple $1 million to make this film.
Yeah, and the campaign was initially very successful. In the first couple of hours, he raised $1 million. By the time most people hear this conversation, he will probably have reached his goal of $2 million. And he makes a very cogent and persuasive argument that he tried to set this movie up at a higher budget level, but he was going to have to sacrifice things that he wasn't willing to sacrifice artistically, including final cut over the film, casting approval, budget. And he felt like the best way to make the movie was to crowdsource it, was to go on the internet, use Kickstarter to raise the money. But it's worth noting that even though Veronica Mars, which was another Kickstarter-funded campaign that raised $5.7 million to finance that project, didn't get a lot of backlash, there is a growing tide of, you know, small but vocal discontent of people who think Zach Braff should go out and maybe spend his own money and raise money rather than depending on donations to finance his film.
You know, we had an independent filmmaker on the show just a couple weeks ago, and he was saying he didn't feel threatened by Veronica Mars at all because he said that anyone who's going to finance, he did his film was Gimme the Loot, very small film. Anyone who's going to want to kick in towards Veronica Mars is not looking around for independent types of films, and therefore he didn't feel like it cost him anything or filmmaker like him. But as you say, this is a little closer to the sweet spot. At the same time, he, you know, you have to give him credit for this. As I said, this video was very engaging. And Zach Braff talks about how the money people might not allow him to do what he wants to do as a director, and that that was not something he wanted to pursue.
Speaking of money, I mean, the Kickstarter donors are basically that. They are not investors. They will not get anything out of this movie outside of maybe if they give a lot of money, they'll have a part named after them. If they give a real lot of money, they get to go to the premiere with Zach Braff and the after party, but they won't benefit from its financial success. Zach Braff will, and Zach Braff has a lot of money. There's a New York Magazine story about his incredibly fancy New York apartment recently. He certainly made a ton of money off Scrubs. So the question is, you know, if Zach Braff really wants to make this movie, why doesn't he scrape together his own $2 million? Because if the movie is successful, Zach Braff will rake some of the profits, and his Kickstarter volunteers won't.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. And you can follow us on Twitter. My handle is at Kim Masters. John Horn is at JG Horn. Coming up later in the show, a U.S. filmmaker who finds himself dazed and confused in China. But first, making two versions of a movie, one in English, one in Norwegian, simultaneously and on the high seas. The 2012 Norwegian movie Kon-Tiki tells the true story of Thor Heyerdahl, the passionate Norwegian adventurer who, in 1947, sailed 5,000 miles from Peru to Polynesia on a balsa wood raft without any engines or navigation equipment. Heyerdahl had a theory that ancient Incans had made the same voyage and discovered Polynesia, and he tried to prove it by replicating their journey. Heyerdahl's book, The Kon-Tiki Expedition, by raft across the South Seas, was a huge international bestseller, and the documentary he made at sea, also called Kon-Tiki, won the Oscar for Best Documentary in 1950. The 2012 dramatization of the Kon-Tiki voyage was nominated for an Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. Though Amour wound up taking the prize, Kon-Tiki became Norway's highest-grossing movie of all time. Now an English version is being released in the U.S. and other countries.
This is Thor. He's stubborn, egotistical, laughably ambitious, but he's also a leader. And because of that, we're going to do what Tiki did. We are going to build a raft and...
and drift into the sunset.
Drift into the sunset.
Where's the raft?
You're sitting on it.
This English version of Kon-Tiki isn't dubbed. The filmmakers shot the movie in English and Norwegian simultaneously, meaning the actors had to perform each scene in both languages. The fact that they were shooting on open water only compounded the difficulty. It turns out that Thor Heyerdahl himself had wanted this movie made in English, and before his death in 2002, he'd been working on the idea with British producer Jeremy Thomas. So filmmakers Joachim Rønning and Espen Sandberg had a mandate from beyond the grave to make Kon-Tiki in English. They recently sat down with the business producer, Darby Maloney, to talk about the two Kon-Tikis.
Espen, why make the same movie twice in two different languages?
It was because we needed the money, the funding from the Norwegian Film Institute. And to get that, you have to make a movie in Norwegian.
So you knew it was going to be in English because that's what Tor wanted, but you also wanted to make it in Norwegian, not because of some affiliation with your country, but because you wanted to get money from the Norwegian Film Board? I mean, well, not to be crass, well, but was it a money decision or was it, something else?
It was both, because we needed the money for sure. But we also wanted it to be as authentic as possible. And they were Norwegian. And in that version, they speak the language that is natural for each scene. So a large portion of that movie is also in English because he was here. He was in the U.S. trying to sell his thesis.
Right, like when he was in New York meeting with National Geographic, et cetera. Those scenes are all in English in the Norwegian version, and they have subtitles.
Exactly.
I'd like to get as much as possible some mental image. So you guys would literally shoot a scene in one
language. I'll tell you all about it. Well, the way we would do the two languages when we were shooting is that we would do two takes in Norwegian and then a couple of takes in English. And then we would turn the camera around and do the reverse shot and do start in English and end up in Norwegian. And sometimes that actually had a huge advantage because there would be nuances surfacing, basically, when we did the different languages. And a lot of times we actually went back and did the other version one more time. Hmm. But I must say that it worked marvelously well production-wise and shooting it. And we were shooting a couple of miles offshore of the island of Malta in the Mediterranean. So we always had land on one side of the raft. So whenever we did that, for instance, a dialogue like that, and we had to do the reverse shot, we did the two languages, and then we had to rotate the raft around so that we get the clear horizon behind our actors. So we also had that to take into consideration.
Whoever's in charge of continuity must have been going crazy. Oh, making sure that...
We all went a little crazy, I think. Looking back at it now, it's 100 sunny days, you know, it's the way the mind works. But sure, yeah, it was heavy going.
How many days was the shoot, Espen?
It was 59 days altogether.
If you had only shot it in one language, how many days do you think it would have taken?
Well, we bought ourselves about 10 extra days.
10 extra days, and I read something like $1.3 million for the budget to accommodate the second language. Is that accurate?
I think even more. I think like 2 million euros, actually, we got extra. Yeah. So that's about $2.8 million.
Right. So while...
It's a good deal.
Right. So while you were assured to get funding by shooting it in English and Norwegian, you had to get that much more money to shoot it in English and Norwegian.
And it was tricky, and we actually ended up not quite making the budget. And Joachim and I had to find the last $200,000 and chip in ourselves to make sure that we started production. We were almost shut down just, I think, about 3 weeks before we started.
And what was that moment like?
Well, we had been working on it for so many years and we loved the story. We had to make it. We were just ready to do whatever it took. And that meant...
Whatever it took.
Yeah.
What
putting
was
our
it?
Houses into the mix.
Is that true? You had to put your houses up?
Yeah, because you don't get a loan in a bank with a guarantee with stocks in a movie. They don't believe in that.
Yeah.
They want bricks and
smart,
mortar.
Smart, actually.
Yeah.
Especially in Norway.
Yeah, especially in Norway. They're not used to that. So, yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmakers Joachim Rønning and Espen Sandberg about their movie, Kon-Tiki. From the beginning, they had the plan and the mandate to make the movie in both Norwegian and English. The films are very nearly identical, except for some edits in the English version to speed up the pacing for U.S. audiences.
I heard, and tell me if this is true, that you can't market this one as an Oscar-nominated film because it was the Norwegian version that was nominated for the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film this year. Is that...
That is correct, yeah.
Surely, it's hard to imagine.
I didn't know that.
I've heard that.
Yeah. I can't imagine Harvey Weinstein would lose an opportunity to invoke Oscar when selling a movie he's distributing.
No comment to that.
It's, yeah, there are some rules, I'm sure.
What kind of involvement are you guys having in the marketing of it abroad?
Well, we show up to everything they tell us to show up to.
It's very important for us. And we grew up with American movies, and that's what inspired us to become filmmakers. And it's great to be here in Los Angeles and get the kind of attention that Contiki is giving us. And it's great to see the attention Contiki is getting. And the Oscar nomination and the Golden Globe nomination, all of that, it helps tremendously, you know, for a film like that to get out into the world.
So, I mean, I can imagine, but I still want to ask you, how important is it for you guys that the English language version do well?
I think that we've already reached further than we could ever dream of, you know, with the Oscars and the Golden Globes and people liking the film. We make films for the audience, I think we can say. And it's always important for us that we find an audience. And we'll see. You never know. But of course it is important, you know. We're storytellers. We want to tell our story to as many people as possible.
And for the financiers, they put in the money for both. So they get to get their money back in part from the film that was already released and in part from this film that's going.
True. Yeah. Yes. And we're already doing well. The movie is the second most successful movie ever in Norway, just beat by our previous movie, Max Manus. So it looks very good. So we're very happy about it.
And you guys were saying before, just being in LA is meaningful to you because you grew up on American movies. Espen, what has it done to your profile here? What kind of offers are you getting? Meetings are you getting here?
Well, we've gotten a lot of meetings, and it's been fantastic. We opened the movie in Toronto, and after that, it just exploded. We were already represented here with agents and manager because of commercials we had done.
Commercials and, stateside?
That too, yeah. We won the Super Bowl a few years ago, the USA Today poll, with a Budweiser commercial. And also because of Max Manus, but it really exploded with Contiki. So we've had a lot of meetings with a lot of studios, and now we have a couple of projects in development that we are very excited about. So, yeah.
Movies, TV?
Movies. Feature. Yeah, we TV is great, but our first love is movies.
I thought I read that you guys were doing something with J.J. Abrams.
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the things. We are we have a deal with Legendary, and we have a deal with Bad Robot, two different projects.
Mm. Well, Legendary is known for comic book stuff. Are you guys going to tell me anything here?
No, we can tell you that this is an original story.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Now, would you ever do the dual language thing again?
No.
Nope. I don't think Legendary wants a Norwegian version.
Would you recommend to other foreign filmmakers who are working in not English language tongue?
It is interesting, and I think for certain projects that, you know, have a certain potential, yeah, it is interesting.
Is it worth it?
Yeah,
yeah, we feel it's
worth it, and it took us this far. You know, we're in the good spot now.
What was the Budweiser commercial?
Rex the dog, it's called. Rex was a movie dog, and he doesn't perform, so the director has to bring him back to the worst moment of his life to make him cry, and successfully does so.
Well, thank you guys so much for talking.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was the business producer, Darby Maloney, speaking with Joachim Roening and Espen Sandberg about the film Contiki. The English language version is in theaters now. Coming up after a short break, a filmmaker who can't finance his film in the States goes to China. To comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Usually when we talk about Americans making movies in China, we're talking about studios trying to find Chinese investors for big movies like Iron Man 3 in the hope, and so far it's mostly just the hope, that their films will get more favorable treatment in the giant Chinese market. But recently, John Horn, film writer for the Los Angeles Times and my regular banter buddy, met a filmmaker who made his movie in China for a very different reason. Namely, he couldn't get it financed anywhere else. Gil Kaufman wanted to make a thriller about a young girl who was kidnapped, but his financing fell through twice. That's not unusual in the movie business, but what happened next is. Kaufman got a call from a U.S. producer in China who had seen Kaufman's only previous film, The Memory Thief, at a festival. This producer was looking for a script he could set up with a new Chinese production company. Kaufman had never been to China, and he certainly did not know the language, but he sent some scripts, and the producer chose one. Only he wanted Kaufman to rewrite the material to avoid riling Chinese censors, and the script, of course, would be translated into Mandarin, but Kaufman would still direct and edit it. He took the offer, but soon after arriving in China, he found that he was out of his depth. So his friend, Tanner Barklow, came to China and began to document the process as a making-of movie. They ended up with the new documentary, Unmade in China.
Now I know why they chose death over exile in the old Greek days, when they said, we will exile you. And the person, no, no, put me to death. I'd rather have that than exile. Which never made sense until I came to China. All of a sudden, the notion of exile became pregnant with meaning.
John Horn sat down with Gil Kaufman to hear more.
What's going on in your mind in terms of making this huge leap to go to a country you've never visited before and direct a film in a language you don't speak a word of?
Partly it was, you know, I thought I was putatively going to get paid. So that was some incentive that I would be getting paid at the end of the day. And I arrived, I did a bunch of pre-production meetings in Beijing and Shanghai, you know, all in very good faith, trying to really make the script as viable and as powerful as we could. But then I didn't anticipate the things that were down the line.
So Hollywood is famous. Studio executives are famous for giving screenwriters and directors notes, ways that they think a script can be improved. Sometimes those notes are helpful. Sometimes they're preposterous. I suspect the same thing is going on in China. But at what point do those notes veer into a direction you did not anticipate?
Yeah, the notes were mandated by some cultural imperatives that they had a list of, like, not too much violence, not too much nudity, which made pretty, you know, a lot of sense. I mean, they're pretty self-explanatory and evident. When it started getting a bit crazy was when I arrived there and they presented me, we had already done four versions of the script, and they presented me with a version seven. And I was wondering what happened to the other three, you know, intermediary stages of the script. And they gave me version seven, and they had someone killing puppies and feeding them to the heroine and stuff like that that had nothing to do with the tone or tenor of the script. And I was flabbergasted. At that point, the cultural changes were no longer cultural. They were just using that as an excuse or an apology to get what they wanted.
Now, when you're talking about they, is that Fundamental Films? Is this your Chinese production company? And how are those decisions being mandated? And also, we should say that cast members are kind of coming and going. Cinematographers are coming and going. But who is pulling the strings?
It was the person who was producing the film, who was executive producing the film, and he had full control. Then again, he was subservient to China Film Group and censors and government pressure as well. So everybody's really second-guessing what the other person wants until you learn to roll with the punches and really kind of accept, you know, that you didn't have the power you thought you did. Like when the leading lady has been replaced and they don't tell you, that's a bit of a shock. But, you know, on the good side, you know, being a communist country, if you wanted a location, they could really get you the location. There was no problem in someone making a call and saying, you want that mall? Okay, done. You've got the mall. You want this? We've got it for you.
What was your thinking about bringing the documentarian along?
Initially, I was sending like some videos or clips home of what was going on or emails. And a few people were saying, oh, we've got to document this. This is surreal. It's absurd. You've got to get this on film. And I was like, no, I'm making a feature. I've got enough on my hands. I can't accommodate. You know, I don't have the bandwidth for anything else. But I relented. After the puppy incident, I was like, okay, let's get someone out here. So a good friend of mine and documentarian, Tana King Barklow, who we co-directed the film together, came out. And he was there all the time, 24/7, like when things were going well and badly. And it provided some sort of comfort to know that that was happening, at least that there was some kind of record going on.
Was there any nervousness among the crew, especially your Chinese bosses, that this documentary filmmaker is showing up and recording what clearly is not totally flattering behavior on their part?
The more I was pointed at the powers that be, there was looks given and kind of we became more and more cautious. And so we had to, and we shot with different equipment. We shot with, you know, the big camera that they saw. We had flip cameras. We had our iPhones. So we were kind of mixing media. But as far as they were concerned, we had a badge from them. It was totally, they knew we had someone come in. It was approved. They said, here's someone who's coming in and he's approved to shoot this, you know, making of. And we gave them, you know, a bunch of footage for their making of, whatever. I don't know what they did with it. And then we had our footage, which is what we made the film with.
The you are not Steven Spielberg, unfortunately, so you don't have Final Cut. But a whole different set of circumstances happened when you're cutting the film. You put together your cut, and then at what point do you see the alternative or the official Chinese version of the film?
Oh, God. No, I think the notion of Final Cut is really inimical to a country like China. I mean, it doesn't mean like if you're a big director, they wouldn't let you. But the fact that you have sensors kind of monitoring little things like what color the shirt should be or what are you doing, you know, it really defies, you know, the idea of giving someone Final Cut. But they had told me from the beginning, you'll edit the film, you'll have a festival cut, everything will be fine. And then I saw their cut months later. They worked on it for 4 or 5 months more. It was a completely different cut. I mean, you know, reinvented from the start. So, I mean, in some way, it's admirable that they could come up with something I couldn't even conceive. But at the same time, it was very painful.
What would you say is the fundamental difference between your version of the film and China's cut of the film?
Mine actually stuck to the script. That's the short answer. Their version was really a second guessing of what an audience, it was an ingratiating version of a film of what an audience might want to see that has been like raised on fast cuts and whatever. And they cut out like a bunch of storylines. So it was really dehumanized in a certain way. I mean, it was like attention deficit really to the nth degree.
Their version got released, appears to have kind of come and gone relatively quickly.
It went pretty quickly. I think it was in over 2,000 screens in China, which is like, you know, every filmmaker in America, indie filmmaker goes, I wish I have that curse happen on me. But it came pretty quickly. And for me, it was always a sore point just because I know it could have really had a real significant mark in China had they followed through with what we had talked about.
China's famous for having rampant piracy. You decide to take advantage of their piracy epidemic by placing your version of the film in some Hong Kong and Chinese video stores. What was the motivation and what happened after you did that?
At the end, when I finished my cut, I did take it to a few festivals. And we showed it, and it got such a good response. You know,
are these festivals in China or
no? They were all here in the States.
Okay.
And but the response was, you know, very strong for filming with subtitles and all that. And I was like, you know what, I should really do to them what they've done to me. And so I went back to China. Tana and I actually went back to Hong Kong, mainland China, and we with a whole bunch load of DVDs and started bootlegging our version of the film, not there. And that's in the movie. And then it leads elsewhere.
Do you think Unmade in China will ever see the light of day in China? I mean, do you have another plot to actually take the documentary into China now?
You know, I'm a bit afraid or trepidatious of it getting there and I don't even talk about it. But at some point it will. I mean, with everything being online and everything going everywhere, I'm sure it's going to somehow disseminate somehow.
Gil Kaufman, I want to thank you for coming in and talking to the business.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was John Horn speaking with filmmaker Gil Kaufman. The documentary, Unmade in China, chronicles Kaufman's experiences trying to make a feature film in China. It's playing in select cities. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to us anytime on demand with the KCRW smartphone apps. And you can hear the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. The show is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.